Welcome to the Wellbeing Ignites Well-Doing podcast, produced by OOT Social Health, where the focus is on exploring the essential elements that drive organizational success, human-centric leadership. Hosted by Adjoa Boahidi, principal of AKB Talent Edge.
Ignites Well-Doing podcast. I'm your host, Tiagi Delanerol, filling in for Adjoa K. Boahidi. Today, my guest is Shannon Balram, Associate Director for Student and Employee Engagement at UC Santa Barbara. We're going to be talking building bridges, enhancing student and employee engagement in higher education. Ultimately, we're going to share and explore Shannon's extensive experience and innovative strategies in fostering engagement and belonging among students and employees in higher education. This episode will delve into how Shannon creates inclusive, supportive communities while addressing challenges in leadership, diversity, and crisis management. So just to give you a little bit of background, Shannon is a seasoned leader in higher education, specializing in student employee engagement, diversity initiatives, and crisis management. As the Associate Director for the Student and Employee Engagement at UC Santa Barbara, Shannon is dedicated to fostering inclusive, vibrant communities that enhance well-being and belonging for students and staff alike. With over 15 years of experience in residence life, leadership roles across institutions, Shannon has spearheaded initiatives that include increased diversity in hiring, strengthen cultural wealth within programs, and provide crucial support during crises. Especially, you know, things like the California Thomas Fire and COVID-19's pandemic. Her dual expertise in student engagement and employee well-being makes her a trailblazer in creating collaborative, thriving campus environments. We're really excited to have you on, Shannon. Welcome.
Oh my goodness. I'm so pleased and honored. So thank you.
We are so happy. Okay. Well, you know, the Employee Wellbeing Council is all about being human-centric in the age of AI. And so you're human. We're going to center around you and start off the podcast with getting to know you a little bit better through two Proust questions. Marcel Proust, as you know, is an essayist and author. He believes that these questions really help get into the heart of who someone is. So to kick things off, we're going to ask, which talent would you most like to have?
Well, I would say the first talent is I'd love to be able to actually have my own podcast.
Okay. We can all make that happen for you.
Yeah. I mean, just the tech and all of the work and energy to also make this happen is just seems so in depth. And it would be a talent that I think would be really interesting. I think the second talent is I would love to be bilingual, if not trilingual. I learned ancient Greek, which is not as useful as I would have hoped it to be. So yeah, that'd be another talent that I would love to have.
You know, it's funny you say that because that was when I was on the podcast on the other side, I said the same thing. I said that like something that I wanted to be able to be, you know, to speak multiple languages and really speak with folks from the heart, right? Sure. Even with AI, it's just not the same as speaking the language. It really helps you connect.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, the next question is, what would you like, if you were to die, actually, if you were to die and come back as a person or thing, what would it be?
I would like to come back as a dolphin. Of a couple different things. They always look like they're having the best time ever. I also think they're highly intelligent. I love water. So just to be able to live in water, enjoy water, to be playful, to be a part of a community. I'd love to be a dolphin. And everyone stops at the beach when you see a dolphin and you just feel nothing but joy. So to be a joy generator in my life, my next life would be such a gift.
Again, that should be on a t-shirt. I am a joy generator. Amazing. I love it. Okay. So, you know, you have such a vast, extensive background in student and employee engagement. We're going to ask, you know, what are the key similarities and differences in how you approach fostering engagement for students versus employees?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think I was thinking about this question quite a bit. And I think the first like reflection that I had is for me, I can speak from my experience. I really believe that values and knowing your values really help drive a lot of your work. As a leader, as someone who's a part of the work of engaging others and supporting and empowering others. So for me, I have three primary values, whether that's connecting with our student staff or connecting with our professional staff. And those three values are, I want to lead with curiosity. So really leaning into that human-centric work where it's about understanding people, providing space for genuine inquiry, and that it's not out of pretense. It's not actually like a genuine desire of like leading with curiosity and also really leaning in with good questions. The second for me is leaning in with courage as well. So you lead with curiosity, you're going to lean in with courage. And the courage part is that for every person that I am entrusted with, that there's this important piece of asking not just good questions, but also I think having the courage to have maybe harder conversations, not shying away from that. I believe Brené Brown talks a lot about like this rumbling, this aspect of what it really means to be committed to another human. And so instead of maybe shying away from hard conversations, leaning in with respect, and knowing that those conversations will lead to growth and ideally growth for the two people that are having them. Well, and then the third for me is really like living with celebration. And so out of that value, I really think taking time to really understand, I mean, we spend so much time at work, whether that's a student staff member who's only working maybe part time, but that's still 20 hours of your life each week to maybe 40 to more hours as a professional staff. So what does it actually mean to like live with celebration in all the different aspects of what we bring to work each and every day? And for some people, celebration just looks like, hey, I gave you a cup of coffee and I see you. And for some, they want party hats and streamers. They want, you know, like me, confetti, joy.
Yes.
I just think that those aspects for me, when I was thinking about this question, I think that's really important to lead with.
I love it. So it's the three C's, right? Curiosity, courage, and celebration. Yeah. Again, I really love the last point around, you know, being joyful and celebrating one's wins, right? Or the team's wins, or just because I feel like even just looking back at my own experience, whenever you do take a moment to celebrate, it really brings forth even the more greater motivation, right? Yes. For everyone around. It's almost like it's like a rallying call.
That's right.
So that's wonderful. And I'm sure your team members, right, folks that work with you are so grateful for you. For that, but that the fact that you take that stance.
Yes, hopefully they feel that way.
of course they will.
Yeah.
Okay, so you've managed responses to major crises like wildfires and the pandemic. How have these experiences shaped your approach to leadership and community care?
Yeah, well, you know, that it's, I think context is really critical. I was thinking about this question as well, you know. So for context, I had just stepped in. It was my very first year where I stepped into a director role for Resonance Life. I had only been in the director role for 4 to 5 months. And within 4 to 5 months, was confronted with a pretty substantial crisis. And that was the California Thomas Fire, which was in 2017. At that time, it was one of the largest fires. And it just lasted forever. And so it actually had started away from campus. And then within a week's time, it was actually moving within the hills of Montecito where the campus was located. And so I was immediately sort of having to navigate that crisis, evacuate campus, ensure that our staff, that they were safe, that they were resourced, and that our students, our collective student community, was also safe. Additionally, fast forward, what I think is really interesting in this period is, so after we evacuated campus, we spent a month having to basically clean the campus, restore the campus, because when a fire comes through, you have ash, you have debris, you have a number of things. And thankfully, we didn't lose any property. The fire was probably about 7 miles away from our institution, so okay. We're really fortunate. But after we did all of that work, welcomed students back within literally not even a day or 2 days of them being back on campus, we had the Montecito debris flow, which was pretty significant. There was about 21, I think, or 23 people who lost their lives in that debris flow. And that was half a mile away from campus, which resulted in a second evacuation of the campus because we had no water. We had no water supply. All the drinking water had been impacted. So I think I like to offer that context because I feel in so many ways no one can ever anticipate a crisis.
Yep.
You know, that day I literally had just was on the phone with my supervisor with the second with the debris flow. Hey, I took a sick day. I'll be back in work. I'll see you in the morning. Oh yeah, there's a storm coming through. Hey, let's make sure we have all of our plans and processes in place, but we'll deal with it in the morning. And then at 4 a.m., it was a whole different reality.
Wow. So how did you handle like the multiple whammies, right? Like in terms of communication and ultimately it's probably gonna, you know, impact to how you lead with empathy.
Yeah. You know, what I learned in that is I think you have to be conscious of yourself.
Mm-hmm.
If not, I'm thankful that there has been a lot of work for self-reflection prior to me ever having to step into that crisis.
Okay.
I was already very conscious of where my own stressors were so that I could, if needed, say, hey, give me a second. I need to take a second so that I can check in with myself so that I can think clearly.
Mm-hmm.
And in that moment, what I realized is I think you have really key responsibilities when you're in a crisis management aspect. And so my first priority was we need to ensure that everyone is safe. And I need to ensure that everyone that is on my staff that's responsible for that has very clear instructions. And so one of my rules, I often say to my staff, I often will take a 5 second pause and I'll actually ask for that. I'll say, hey, there's a lot going on. I need 5 seconds so that I can just in quiet think, exhale. If I'm feeling anxious, I can let go of that anxiety. If I'm feeling that there's a lot of noise, because often with crisis, there can be a lot of like what feels like noise, a lot of people coming at you, a lot of people looking for direction.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll take a 5 second moment to pause, exhale, and then I step in and then I need to give really clear instruction. Hey, these are our priorities. Let's be very clear that these are a priority. When it comes to the people aspect, what I learned in that experience is that everyone is also managing their own internal crisis. And so you can't treat or expect everyone to have the same sort of energy to engage and be a part of the solution. For some people, they may need to step out. So I made a pretty solid rule when I was in that experience to say, if you think you can step in and you can provide leadership at this crisis moment, I'm calling you and I'm inviting you to do that. For those of you who recognize that this is beyond your limit, I want to encourage you to take care of yourself, take care of your families. You are free of any responsibility. What I ask of you is if you step away, for those of us that are stepping in, that when we need you, once we've gotten through this immediate crisis, we're going to need to exhale. We're going to need to take time to recover. And that's when I really need you to step in. Because I think people may have just different like touch points for where they can really step in to help support a crisis. We can't assume everybody's going to be at the same set point. It's just, that's not fair. We don't know people's medical histories. We don't know what past trauma people are bringing in. Some people have dispositions. You know, I have a disposition where if there's a medical issue or a crisis, I'm the first to put myself in a scene to be of support. That's that's innate to me. Some others step away. And that isn't that one is not better than the other. In fact, I think some of that's just related to our biology. And so based off of that, we need to know our different strengths. So when I step in, I need to rely on the person that stepped back to come in to give me a break. And they have like recharged so that they can step into that space. I hope that makes sense.
Yeah, that really makes a lot of sense. And it sounds like, so couple key takeaways that I'm taking away from this is, you know, one is you got to take a moment to assess the situation. So to think clearly, right? That's what I heard. And then the second really is around understanding your team and your team dynamic and the makeup, right? And finding ways to tap into everyone's strengths.
Yes.
So yeah, it's so great. And again, this is really leading with human-centric leadership, right? Hence the reason why I reached out to you. I knew I had a good feeling about you, Shannon. So there you go. At West Point College, you increased diversity in hiring from 11%, which is low, to 41%. Incredible. What strategies did you implement, and how did they impact the overall culture?
Yeah. And real quick, the college is Westmont, W-E-S-T-M-O-N-T.
Oh, my apologies. Westmont College.
All good. I'll first say that I think it's a team effort. So when I started in my career at Westmont College, I had just moved from a resident director position to an assistant director position. And I had a dear colleague, Joshua Canada, who was also a part of this team in this work and actually volunteered to do an assessment, because when we looked at that percentage, to your point, it varied every year. Sometimes it was as low as 5-6% to having diverse applicants to being 11% was at its highest. And for us, several of us on that team, to your point, we felt like that is pretty significantly low, especially when you compare it to the student population. So at the student population, it was at 25-27%. So Westmont is a predominantly like white institute. But even still, in our leadership structure, it was almost as if we were like persistently white, because we're not even reflecting the student body. And for me, as someone who really cares about the work of DE&I, and also Joshua and several others that were on that team, you know, it just felt like that is such a disservice to our students. And if we actually do want to help support bringing in more diverse students to our college campus, then we really need to reflect that in our student leadership positions and our professional leadership positions. So Josh did an amazing labor of love to do assessment. So did a number of assessment projects to really reach out to past alumni who would identify as diverse, reached out to a number of additional other current students, and basically was asking them as to why they weren't applying for the position. And particularly that was the demographic we were after. Hey, if you attended this college, why did you never apply to be an RA? Or if you had applied to be an RA, what do you think were the barriers for you in not being hired? Okay. Josh learned that we had a couple of different data points that we needed to take a look at. First of all, a lot of our students said, well, I didn't apply because I didn't really see me represented. I didn't see me in the leadership. I didn't see me in the student leadership. And so it didn't feel that that was a space that I would either be welcomed in or that I feel like I wanted to even invest my time in. It also, I think, highlighted that some of our practices, because it had traditionally been under one particular demographic, had not been as culturally informed about maybe some of our policies, some of the things that we were doing programmatically. And because we had not been inclusive, again, it was a barrier to people wanting to feel like they wanted to be a part of that work. So based off of that data, it really, you can either take that data and you can just ignore it.
Yeah.
You can take that data and say, oh, we're now informed. Look at us. We're informed. Or you can take that data and you can begin to say, we've got to make some serious, significant shifts and changes. And thankfully, my supervisor at that time was incredibly motivated to make changes based off of the data that was presented to him. And it was through his help, it was through a team effort that we began to make some significant changes. And some of those significant changes were, we need to look at our mission statement. Our mission statement didn't even have the word diverse in it. It didn't say anything about us valuing or aspiring to being a diverse and inclusive leadership program. We need to look at our professional hiring, because if our professional hiring isn't accounting for maybe systematic barriers as well that are leading to more white applicants being hired and less diverse applicants being hired, then we're not going to have that representation, that cultural wealth that we feel is really important. I will say you have to balance that, right? Because this is not about us hiring people for performative reasons or making anyone be sort of a quote unquote token diverse hire. That comes up a lot.
Yeah.
But I think you need to have that reality. But the other reality is you need to acknowledge that there are systems that are going to have preferences over others, and that there's inequitable experiences in that that then lead to practices often hiring one type of person, bias, for example.
Yeah. I like what you brought up a little bit earlier in terms of it's almost like sometimes folks preempt even applying because of their perceptions, yes, right, of what's going on. And they're having a dialogue inside their heads. So if there is kind of even an indication that an organization is more apt to wanting diversity within their student body or within the work environment, then perhaps it'll give them the green light, right, to go ahead, like the permission to go ahead and, oh, yeah, of course I'll apply. But I like the fact that you at least, you know, recognized it and then did something about it, like, and yeah, went out and did all of those surveys and like asking and really trying to find out what's doing this.
Yeah. I think it's interesting to think like within 1 year of just simply changing our mission statement, looking at our professional hiring staff, we saw the numbers immediately shift and change.
It begins to show you, right? Wow. Because that is such a significant change too.
Yeah.
That you saw. And it was all around your intention.
Like, that's right.
You know, you were really intentional about wanting to be perceived a different way. I really applaud you for that.
Thank you. Yeah.
So let's get into, you know, the inclusive leadership elements. How do you create programs and policies that foster a sense of belonging and inclusion for diverse populations in higher education?
Yeah. Well, I think what matters most is that my approach has really been, we need to really center student voices. So when I look at all the different identities that I have, I'm going to have my experience, my perspective, but that's going to be very different if I'm trying to create more diverse opportunities and experiences for our students, because I only have, you know, I'm a white woman with citizenship at the United States. I'm able-bodied, like all the things that how I show up and take up space positively and maybe even negatively. But what matters is I think I'm also not a student. I am 40 years old, love being 40, but I'm no longer a college student, you know? And so when I think about that, I think what matters is we need to create a space where we really center our students' voices for all the different experiences that they bring when they come to live with us in housing for a year or up to 4 years. And so that really does require us, I think, back to that initial value, we need to lead with curiosity and really trying to understand that my college experience 20 years ago is far different from what these college students are walking in with. And so I need to be curious. And I also want to understand, additionally, for our students who come from diverse backgrounds, what really does help them feel a sense of belonging and not assume that just because I'm the educator, I'm the professional, I'm the one that's doing all the studying, I'm reading, that I may have some like inklings of knowledge, but people can't be reduced to books and people can't be reduced to facts. You need to meet people and you really need to allow them to have voice. So I do think that that's been my approach. Mm-hmm. And it takes a lot of work. And so I often tell people, you got to be patient in this work because we also don't want to run and start doing things that we think are good without, again, centering the people and slowing ourselves down just enough so that we can be really intentional in our work and it's not just performative.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And how do you do that? Like right now, is it surveys or do you meet with the various student groups or the student union? Like how do you get at really kind of that deeper understanding?
Yeah, so the different institutions that I've been at have been vastly different. And they're both different institutions. One's a small liberal arts institution, you know, with only about 1,200 students. UCSB has 20-something thousand students with 10,000 of them in housing. So it's very vastly different, right?
Yes.
But I do think both, right, often we rely on assessment, so surveys, and they all have different names for the different surveys that they do. But a lot of them are asking about how our students feel a sense of belonging, what their experience is like in housing. And then I think you have to kind of use that data to give you one snapshot.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think the second snapshot is what often I would say you can do more formal student focus groups. I know here currently at UCSB, we're having conversations about implementing that again and bringing that back since COVID kind of disrupted some things, but doing more formal assessment student focus groups. But I also tend to do a lot of informal student focus groups. So when I'm asked to present, or I'm asked to do anything that is engaging students in their learning, I will actually sometimes often add a question and I will throw it to the group because it's a captive audience and I'm getting information in that moment. So an example, we have living learning communities and some institutions are calling them affinity themed housing. We've called ours living learning, you know, communities. In the higher ed world, you have to have one thing that makes it an LLC and another thing that makes it an affinity themed housing. But no one seems like when I'm reading this, I'm like, well, what do the students think? So I was teaching a session on LLCs and I asked the group, what are your thoughts? And it was such valuable feedback. Our students of these living learning communities said, you know, hey, I don't like the language of affinity themed housing because it makes me feel like my identity or the things that I hold dear to my identity are reduced to a theme versus it really being who I am as a human. And I just thought, wow, that's valuable data because if we make any changes, that voice needs to be at the center of our mind because if LLCs are intentionally meant to support our students in their growth and their development and their celebration of who they are, if we change the name because we think it fits this larger student affairs, you know, rule, we've completely discounted our student voice. And I think that can cause impact. I wouldn't want any of our students feeling like they're just a theme, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, like you wouldn't have known if you didn't ask, right? And so I think that's also just a really good key theme. It goes back to your values that you spoke of, right? Around the curiosity piece. And that's gonna really help you come across as an authentic, caring, empathetic leader, I think, between students and employees. So there you go. That's really good. And it's something that I think even, you know, the audience that's listening in, right? They're also looking to level up their human-centric leadership skills. And it's important to learn from you, Chin, right? With regards to exactly like ways in which you're kind of tapping into that. So now we're going to go into, you've actually done a certification in mental health first aid. It really demonstrates your commitment to mental health. How does this inform your work in supporting students and employees?
Yeah. You know, in some ways, very practically. So in my former roles, I was doing a lot of engaging with students who were working through a number of mental health, some would say crisis. I think others trying to sort through what support and resources they may need towards their emotional health. Mm-hmm. And what I learned through that certificate and how it's really shaped a lot of my approach is that language matters. And so often, again, sitting with people, sometimes in my work, people will say, oh, yeah, students of concern. And that's usually related to students who are working through a number of different, you know, mental health, again, crisis or moments that are impacting themselves or others. But I don't necessarily love that language because I think that feels – I think instead maybe it's a student of care because we need to care for the student. Yeah. And I want our language and all of our emails and when we're in meetings and when we – because if a student is in front of us, the very student that we're trying to figure out how to offer resources and support to – if they were to hear, oh, a student of concern, I think that rhetoric feels very isolating versus what our intent really is to care for the student and to give them as many options as possible to support their overall health. From a professional staff angle, I think that's really shaped how I want to engage our staff is to help them also think through, you know, how do we in our work look at our language and think about how that language can shape or impact others. And so that's kind of some of those pieces that I really took away from that training was that I think, you know, we need to be conscious and mindful and also humble enough to name, you know, hey, I've been saying this for years and it's actually not helpful. It's not helpful. And to own that with the staff that you're leading, you know. Yeah. And share that because language is evolving each and every day and our consciousness even is also evolving. And so we need to create safe spaces to where all of us can kind of lean into that work.
I love it. You're absolutely right. And, you know, it's so important for all of us to have a sense of like self-awareness so that we can also bring that awareness to the communication that we are yielding with others, right? So thank you for sharing that. So you've actually taught some leadership courses in the past. What advice would you give to emerging leaders in higher education?
I love this question. I do.
Right.
I just think, because some of my work too, you know, I work with, you know, students, but I also work with a number of actually like emerging professionals in our field. And so it was really a fun question to step back and think, oh, yeah, actually, I'm going to take my thoughts and I'm going to share that with them later this week. But I think some of the advice I would give them is, again, we need to lead with purpose and we need to lead with values. We need to really know our why.
Okay.
And some of that is multifaceted. You know, we need to know our personal why. Like, why am I showing up to work? Why am I doing this? And it can vary for a lot of different people, but why am I here? And especially in the work of education, in our current context here in the United States, I mean, I was just reading about the Department of Education possibly being eliminated. That has some serious implications, right? So knowing our why, I think, is important. But then my work is also helping our collective community know at UCSB, this is our why. This is why we are doing this work. Our educational priority has been residents are prepared to move the world. It's very ambitious. We're probably going to likely change that. We're in a process of review to really assess, is that actually our why? But currently, that's our why. And so I feel really tasked to say, hey, know your why. And also, this is our why. And this is what's shaping how we are showing up and doing our work. I also really try, I would try to encourage, again, a lot of our emerging staff in the work to not only know your purpose, to know your values, but I really would say prioritize relationship building. And
love it.
Yeah, I feel that, right?
Yeah, because we have so many to-dos in our day, right? So many different things. It's even just taking even a minute to check in with someone that humanizes the interaction.
That's right. Yeah. And I think from all different levels, you know, that's something like, did you take time to, you know, when you're walking through your building to acknowledge our ops team? That's people who are our custodial staff. That's people who, and it's easy just to walk by them. But to take time to really think through, hey, you know, we keep passing each other. I'd love to know your name and recognize all the different people that are a part of this community that make this place what it is. So students, our ops team, to all the way to leadership. Sometimes people get really nervous, you know, when they see, you know, oh, that's a senior leader, but they're also a human. And they're also a part of this living organization that is all hopefully trying to consistently work towards the same goal. So relationships matter. We should work to really know each other. And to your point, we have a lot to do, a lot of tasks. But you know, I started implementing in a lot of my staff meetings. What I often say, we're gonna center ourselves, and so we're gonna do and I prioritize it every meeting. I'd love to do a check-in. We're going to center ourselves so that we can kind of engage in the work. So where are we starting today? For some people, they're like, I'm at a 20% today. There's a lot going on at home. Okay. We may not use the meeting to unpack it, but at least I know, okay, when I'm connecting with such and such person, this is where they're at. And so maybe after the meeting, I can check in with them. Hey, do you need any help? Do you need any support? Especially as a supervisor, right? Yeah. And empowering people to care for themselves, but also empowering people to not feel like they have to not bring their humanity into the door, because life happens. Some days I'm at a 20%. I'm a mom. I have two kids.
Yeah. Yes. I have two yeah. youngins, right? Two young yes, ones.
I do.
So you have a lot of empathy because of, you know, you being a mom too. Like you understand some of the struggles that folks with families that they have and even aging parents, right? Like I think that's also something that a lot of I've heard come up a lot with other conversations that we've had.
Yeah. And I actually am convinced, because I know a lot of, I was reading, was it the Harvard Review? I can't remember where I pulled it. It's probably with the human resources management, but they're talking about like one of the number one reasons why people leave jobs isn't always salary. Salary is can be in there, but it's based off of your experience at work, your work culture.
Yeah.
And that stems from your supervisor. And it can also stem from the supervisor and how they create a space that people feel that they belong. And that they also feel that they can exist in that space. And so for me as a working mom, that's something I'm really in tune to. Like I'm not going to sacrifice my first priority, which is my marriage and to my children. And so UCSB has created such an environment that I feel like I can do all of those roles well.
Yeah, that's really great that, you know, you're with an organization that values you as a human, that you have, that you come with multiple facets, right? And that's the beautiful thing. I think that when anyone brings their true authentic self in their various kind of roles that they play in their lives, you have much more creative, I think, and dynamic workforce that's going to ultimately help the organization thrive. Because I think thriving is what we are ultimately aiming for, right? That we have a sense of purpose, that we are happy and fulfilled, and we're hitting our targets. So these are also important elements. I'm actually going to think a little bit about the future now, right? So what do you see as the future of engagement in higher education, particularly in creating resilient, inclusive communities for both students and employees? What do you think are the trends that are coming down the pike?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think there's a couple trends. I was just reading the 2024 Higher Ed Insight. They had a report that they had offered and was digging through it. And I thought a couple things I thought were really interesting. One is that 57% of college students are having to choose between their college experience and a basic need.
Oh, my goodness.
So, and we've talked a lot about the increasing cost of college education, and but that data point caught me. And I also thought it was really interesting that like 40% of college students, particularly, don't finish within 6 years. And most of them may not even finish and may not even like actually succeed in getting their degree, which can have some substantial impact towards maybe their future contributions, their future access.
Yeah.
So when I look at that, and then I also look at what's currently happening in our context here in the United States of like what our political administration is choosing.
Mm-hmm.
I see my engagement really zeroing in on helping our staff, student staff, for example, find access to employment so that they can support their basic needs.
Yeah.
And then I'm also looking at our professional staff and thinking through how do I also ensure that they are resourced to help support in their work the empowerment of like, hey, we want to be able to get as many students to graduate because that's what they started. And we know that that can be such a life-changing trajectory. So how do I resource you? How do I support you? How do I feel that you feel inspired to do that work? The third dynamic that I'm going to be watching is currently I'm in California, so I actually have the privilege of doing work that is related. I can say the words diversity, equity, and inclusion. Some of my colleagues at other institutions outside of California, they're not permitted to say even those words. And so there's, I think, a lot of misinformation and misunderstanding about what diversity, equity, inclusion really is.
Yeah.
And so we're going to have to really sort through that. And I think we need leaders who can kind of courageously forge a way for honoring work that really is about centering people, and part of centering people is understanding that they're diverse.
Yeah.
Centering people is also understanding that there are systems that may not always include them. And so, what do we do to dismantle some of those systems, right? So that those people can really feel a place, a belonging, and that they're not met with a deficit mindset, but they're seen with the mindset of no, you bring diversity, and that is wealthy, that is rich, that makes us stronger and better. Because if we all think the same way, act the same way, have the same perspective, we know that that's actually not going to bring us to this rich work of creativity and rich work that allows us to have new insights, concepts. I mean, that to me is really It saddens me, you know, when I see that happening, because I fear, you know, how that's going to impact some of our students and their access. I fear how that's going to shape even students who may benefit from whatever, you know, for being white, for example, like that they may not be able to step in and think through what it means to actually lead with empathy, to lead with cultural curiosity. Yeah, it's an interesting trajectory. So I think we're going to need to really think about how we do this in very intentional ways, even if we're told, nope, you can't use the words DE&I.
Well, that is quite the predicament, right? That some of your colleagues are in, and thing, you know, like thankfully you're in California where they're they see the value, right? And so ultimately what I'm taking away from that, you know, is really around, you see the trend of having the ability to explore diversity in bringing the richness to the workforce is super important. And of course, obviously to the students as well. So this actually brings us to our very last question, Shannon. I wanna take you back to you as a young lady, right? A young lady. Well, in your early 20s, what type of advice would you give to yourself back then, knowing everything that you know now?
Yeah. I give myself two words of wisdom. The first wisdom is, I think I'm a millennial, and we hunger for mentorship. Just hunger for it. But I think I really wish someone had told me. And so if I could tell myself, is that, you know, you need to honor your own voice and you need to honor your own convictions. I think I was very much into people pleasing. And some of that was rooted in sort of, I think, some of my generational identity. Some of that's related to my own childhood story. And I really wish I had caught that earlier so that I could have made maybe different decisions, right? That I think it wasn't about people pleasing, but more so about owning my own sense of agency, and that I'm allowed to have my own thoughts and my own perspectives, and as a result, my voices. I think the second is, I would tell myself it's okay to not know everything and to actually just like calm down, down, make some coffee or tea and just lean into the joy of not knowing everything, you know? And if somebody asks you a question and you're like, I actually have no, I don't even know what that is, that's okay. You don't need to know what that is. And to really like model early in my leadership career, just the gift of being like, yeah, I don't know. There's so much out there. How could any one individual really know everything? Kind of lean into that curiosity a lot earlier. So I think those would be the two things I would tell myself.
I love it. And I'm gonna be frank with you. You know, many of the leaders now that we've interviewed, I would say 50%, maybe even 70%, have said very similar, you know, pieces of pearls of wisdom in terms of just not feeling like they had to have it all figured out, right? In early on in their starting off their life, which is quite the reflection, right? Now that you're 20 years after that, you start to really see that you don't need to have everything figured out, and it's okay to be curious and to learn and to grow along the process. And one thing that I said was even like just really enjoying the journey.
Yeah,
we're on a journey, right? And it's amazing. It's so nice. Like we actually won the lottery just by being born.
That's right. Like what's the gift in that? It's interesting. So I just went to the seminar a couple of weeks ago, and this is staying with me, and especially given our political context. But I really loved this advice. Alonzo Kelly runs a consulting company, and UCSB brought them to do critical thinking and leadership. Alonzo Kelly. I was like, it was so simple. And he said, one of my taglines is I say, when he's engaging with people and especially hard conversations, he'll say, you know, it's not that you're wrong. It's just that it's incomplete. And I loved that because what it brought into me was this notion of like, gosh, you know, how many times like we feel so adamant about our perspective, our context, and in many ways we feel right about it. But maybe it's not complete. So what is the humility even in ourselves, right, to be open to even my own perspective that I'm so adamant about? Like, am I stepping back and being like, actually, is that a complete opinion? Is that a complete perspective?
Yeah. Well, it's good, though. It's good that you have the ability to give yourself some of that space and to reflect, right? I think one of the other things that I've noted is really around having moments of reflection, like giving yourself space to reflect is so critical. I think to happiness, right? To overall happiness, because going back to, I love how we started. So going back to your values, which is so great. And I think if anything I'm taking away is everyone should be writing their own mission statements and values. Value statements for themselves. So really yours is around curiosity, courage, and celebration. And with that, we're going to celebrate you right now and conclude. Thank you so much for your time today. This was such a joyful conversation. And on behalf of the Wellbeing Council, we really appreciate your time.
Oh, and thank you so much. Again, super honored and love the work that you're doing and can't say enough of just the warmth and experience that I have felt and being invited to share my story. So I just want to say thank you, thank you, thank you.
You're welcome, welcome, welcome.
Thank you for joining us on the Wellbeing Ignites Well-Doing podcast, brought to you by OOT Social Health. We hope today's conversation has sparked new insights and inspired you to prioritize well-being in your journey to organizational success. Remember, when well-being ignites, well-doing follows. Stay tuned for more episodes as we continue to explore the power of human-centric leadership. Until then, be well and lead with purpose.